Hi there, Duncan Green here with the latest roundup of posts on From Poverty to Power. It's been a long and grueling week. A lot of work finishing off How Change Happens, lots of teaching commitments. Only this podcast stands between me, a glass of wine, and the first semi-final of the Rugby World Cup. So I'm going to crack on. This is going to be a summary of 2 weeks' posts, just three posts each week, three in a bit. So here we go. So we had a couple of links I liked, although I am finding it harder to get decent links because Twitter's gone down the tubes. But I did see a bit of good news out of India for a change. So on September the 21st, India's Parliament passed a bill reserving a third of the seats in its lower house and in state assemblies for women. So I'd love to hear more from any colleagues out there who know more about India. They've long had this reservation, as it's called in India, for local government, for local panchayats and things. Is it significant that it's now in the lower house? What do they think is going to happen? How did it get through the BJP? So would love to know more. And the second thing I'll pick out from links I liked is just I'm an increasing fan of The New Humanitarian. I think it's a great website, great magazine, great roundups. And there was a piece they had on aid agencies and politicians need to understand the political economy of camps for internally displaced people before sounding off about aid diversion. At the forefront of the diversion are the so-called gatekeepers, influential private individuals linked to local clans who, in the case of Somalia, run Mogadishu's IDP camps. They deal directly with the aid agencies and, according to the UN, leverage their control over food beneficiary lists to extort payments from the displaced. Yet research shows that IDP payments to gatekeepers should not be seen as simple extortion. There's a much more complex, even mutually beneficial relationship is at play. And so this basic question which keeps surfacing, one person's corruption or extortion is as another person's informal tax. A tax for services, for example. And, you need to understand this before rushing to judgment and saying, not a penny is wasted, blah, 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 because actually these people are providing crucial security, from the sound of it, for IDPs living in camps. The next post I did was dealing with a dilemma, which is I have a growing pile of review copies, books that I'm supposed to review, and I can't review them all, and at some point they're going to fall over and I'm going to, they're going to crush me alive. So I thought, I'll let the people decide. So I put up six and asked people to vote, and the rest, well, certainly the bottom three are just going straight to the Oxfam shop. The other three I hope to get around to. I will definitely review the winner. And I did put up the blurb for each one. So even the ones that go to the Oxfam shop get a plug on the blog. So the winner is Erica Harper, The Last 10%. Criticism that the development sector has not delivered in terms of eliminating extreme poverty, fast-tracking growth and preventing conflict is neither new nor surprising. In fact, it may be the one thing that scholars, donors and practitioners agree on. While many of these concerns are valid, this book makes a case that the sector is closer to unlocking the gates to more effective and efficient development outcomes than is popularly believed. Specifically, it argues that by overturning a few myths, making better use of evidence, and employing some different rules, practitioners, policy specialists, and donors can foster the changes in the development architecture that are needed to reach the 10% of the world's population still living in extreme poverty. Engaging, provocative and clear-sighted, all books are according to the blurbs, the book provides insight into interventions around democratic governance, refugee response, counter-terrorism, gender mainstreaming, environmental protection and private sector engagement. It is instructive reading for professionals across the development sector, think tanks and NGOs. So it does actually sound quite interesting, so I'm quite glad it won the vote. The vote also demonstrated that there are a few people still reading the blog, which was nice. And even better, Erica then got in touch, said, "Oh, just been looking at your blog after someone sent this to me. Can I write a post for you?" So it's a win-win-win. It's great. Next post was based on a chat. I often write blogs based on, somebody phones up and says, "Can we have a chat about X?" And then in return for chatting, I get a blog out of it. And this one was with Cherry and Matthews, who's a ex-Fam colleague, ex-Oxfam colleague, who's just coming in to be the big boss at HelpAge International. And he just phoned me up and said, look, I'm just coming in. Can I just pick your brains on stuff? And it really got me thinking about how we talk about the role of older people in development. So we were talking about future possible directions for HAI, HelpAge International, mainly centered on narratives and tactics, which is what I picked out in the blog. So narratives. Obviously, no one these days wants to go with older people as victims, which manages to combine ageism and poverty porn. But I have questions even over portraying older people as fighting for the rights of older people. Have a look at HAI's Older Not Over campaign. It's inspiring, but it also raised questions for me. How many older people self-identify as such? After all, the experience of aging is highly intersectional. Older people are at the forefront of a bunch of age-spanning activism on issues like climate change or women's rights, or in my case, talking about activism to anyone who'll listen. They may prefer to see themselves as activists on one of these issues rather than be pigeonholed as older people. How to recognise that and build a movement out of such disparate parts? Older people may well be making unique meta contributions, e.g. through their emphasis on intergenerational cohesion. You know, brackets, we want to make the world fit for our grandchildren, or as particularly powerful volunteers. Think of the phases of life and activism very crudely. From 60 onwards, there are potentially decades during which older people have resources, financial, social, knowledge, and the time to use them. In all previous phases of life, you either have time or resources, but seldom both. I saw the power of older activists, especially indefatigable nuns, at CAFOD, and it left a marked impression. You can also see that role in later life playing out in the research by IDS and Oxfam on governance diaries in countries like Myanmar and Pakistan. There, older people like retired civil servants become the intermediaries who help fix people's problems at the grassroots, acting as a go-between with the state. Okay, it's not entirely voluntary. Some kind of informal payment in cash or in kind is usually involved. Thanks for the chicken. But it is an important and little recognised role. I would love someone to do ageing diaries to uncover where, when and how older people engage in influencing the communities or influencing for the communities or societies around them in different countries. I suspect it would uncover a whole lot of things that conventional tropes on older people just ignore. And then tactics. If it starts to sign up individual older members as older people as members, could HAI act as a clearinghouse for all this experience and time, putting people in touch with each other and saying, hey guys, now get on with some influencing. According to your online forms, you guys are all retired tax accountants and lawyers. You're the experts. So please come up with a campaign on a wealth tax and we will brand it, but otherwise we'll just let you get on with it. After all, you have the networks and credibility. This also made me wonder if conventional campaign models, at least in the North, are to some extent rooted in experience of student or youth campaigning, where the foot soldiers are treated as such by the generals back in HQ, with a focus on centralised leadership, planning and control, rather than cut them loose, back them and see what happens, which is what you'd have to do with older people. Finally, academic partnerships. It's relatively easy to find partners to work on services for older people. But older people as leaders and campaigners, that doesn't have any obvious fit with existing disciplinary boundaries, as far as I can see, which can be a big stumbling block. Who's working on this? And then I showed a campaign video and asked people to critique it. And there were some good comments in comments. So that did get a conversation going. And then, you know, like everybody else, I was just transfixed and horrified by what's going on in Palestine and Israel. I didn't really have any great insights to share on the blog, but my partner did send me, I don't know if it's a poem or a set of exhortations or advice, but it's from a psychotherapist called Esther Perel. And it says, and I'll just read it out. Be careful to separate people from the policies of their governments. Be careful to separate people from the actions of terrorists who live among them. Be careful not to collapse history and context into narrow interpretation. Be careful not to eschew complexity and nuance for the sake of memification. Be careful to recognise that grief for one side does not mean hate for the other. Be careful to understand that support for one side does not mean hate for the other. be careful of gaslighting on a mass level, disinformation and denial of loss. Be careful not to dismiss the excruciating and real pain of others. Do not make it worse. Be careful not to say things online that you would not say to someone in real life. Be careful not to add a hatred on top of hatred, where you're all being crushed underneath its compounding weight. Be careful not to lose empathy for those with whom you disagree. Be careful not to dehumanize others. Doing so dehumanizes you. Do not lose touch with the parts of you needed most: your compassion, your humanity, your care. I thought those were very beautiful words, which I think everybody can apply in their lives. Very big change of gear to the next post, which was a geek post. Will growth be enough to end poverty? New projections of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And this was a guest post by Arya Fanchouri Youssef, Zuziana, Ahmed Kamarul Zaman, and Andy Sumner. In new analysis for UNU Wider, which is the UN University, we assess progress towards the global poverty-related SDGs, specifically monetary poverty, undernutrition, child and maternal mortality, and access to clean water and basic sanitation. Our analysis then looks forward, making projections on the state of global progress over the coming years up to the 2030 deadline for meeting the SDGs. Too long didn't read, it's not looking good. Our findings show that economic growth alone will not be enough to end global poverty and meet the global poverty-related SDGs, which will be missed by a considerable distance. That's just numbers. We need to remember what they mean in terms that they are all too human. Millions of lives blighted unnecessarily by sickness, poverty, and death. These basic goals will not be achieved by 2030 without radical changes in policies to address national and global inequalities. Stronger emphasis is needed on inclusive growth and productive capacities, SDG 8, alongside social policy. In the 1980s, many developing countries experienced stagnant or declining progress on many indicators of standards of living, earning the decade the infamous Lost Decade label. Our sobering new projections indicate that we may face another lost decade in the 2020s unless urgent action is taken. We make new projections across a set of poverty-related SDGs with a consistent methodology. I'll leave the methodology to people who want to read the paper. Why now? Well, we're halfway to the 2030 deadline. What do we find? The headline findings for countries of the global south: over 600 million people will still be in extreme poverty in 2030. The number of undernourished people will be higher in 2030 than in 2015 when the SDGs were agreed, reaching 665 million in 2030. More than one in five children will be stunted in 2030. There will be an increase in the number of people living in extreme poverty in sub-Saharan Africa and low-income countries. Though most of the world's undernourished people will continue to be in middle-income countries. One in 10 of the population of developing countries will still lack access to clean water. One in three people in sub-Saharan Africa and in low-income countries. More than one in five people in developing countries will still lack basic sanitation. What should be done? Urgent policy action is required. There is an urgent need for redistribution. To change course, we need urgent policy action on two fronts. First, a stronger focus is needed on inclusive growth and productive capacities. Specifically, new international financing needs to be made available through debt relief or other forms of finance to expand the space across countries of the global south to ensure that a stronger focus on SDG 8 can happen. Second, that focus should entail redistribution alongside growth, though through policies that build productive capacities, introduce or expand income transfers, and ensure sufficient public investment to meet the health, water and sanitation SDGs. And that got picked up by a couple of other blog sites who thought it was a good piece. And then the final one, I think, of the week. What would make an atheist spend a day discussing faith and development? So this was another chat. It's the season of chats on Zoom. Had a good chat last week about one of my enduring hobby horses, the role of faith in development and the aid sector's massive secular blind spot. The conversation was with Christian Aid's Lila Caballero Sosa, who with Islamic Relief, the Joint Learning Initiative and the University of Leeds is putting together a big event on faith and development for next spring. Her background briefing nicely captures the main issues. As the democratic... Sorry, I'm getting tired and I'm making mistakes. Cup of tea, hold on. As the demographic weight of the global south increases, the world is becoming more rather than less religious. Religious faith is a major element of the social and political context in which international development efforts take place and plays a significant part in the identity, beliefs and daily decisions of a large majority of the world's people. Despite this landscape, many mainstream development actors have struggled to engage effectively with religion as a factor in development, or indeed to work with religious actors. There is a need to apply a faith-literate approach on a wider scale to development, as this can help improve community acceptance and effectiveness, especially in those areas that relate to norms and behaviours such as gender-based violence, public health, peacebuilding and good governance. And full disclosure, I am a lifelong atheist, but I'm also an admirer of faith groups and their activists ever since my formative years in Latin America and 7 years at CAFOD in the late 90s and early 2000s, which is probably why Lila got in touch with me. So some of the points we touch on. Faith-based and secular aid organisations is actually a bit of a false dichotomy. Oxfam was set up by Quakers and other Christians and still has some Quaker DNA. We're never allowed to claim for even the tiniest drop of booze on expenses. But more importantly, many of its partners and their individual staff and activists are motivated by their faith. Yet this is somehow filtered out in the official story. The best practice guides and strategies, which often combine a high level of rationalism and progressive politics, but avoid any mention of faith. Faith-based policymaking may be what actually happens in many cases, but evidence-based policymaking gets all the airtime. Faith is all about norms, but norms are complicated. At one end, there are more moral norms, things people subscribe to simply because they are right, whatever other people say. A lot of these are faith-based, harnessing deep religious narratives to raise awareness and action on topics like climate change has to be a good idea, as Alex Evans has argued. But these days, demonstrating a preferential option for the poor, in the language of liberation theology, could incorporate a number of less obviously religious ideas, such as Amartya Sen's definition of development as the freedoms to do and to be, the push for localising power and resources to those closest to the people we are trying to help, and acknowledging and respecting the centrality of faith in the lives of marginalised people and communities around the world. Decolonisation surely has to include respect for the faiths of formerly colonised peoples. As an example, when COVID forced the white men in shorts to leave, One of the first things that humanitarian organisations in the Pacific did was to introduce prayers at the start of their meetings. And there's some links to interesting research on that. At the other end of the spectrum, working with faith can get very instrumental. When I asked our staff and partners in the Congo, DRC, whether they worked with the Catholic Church, which is arguably the DRC's only fully national institution, they replied, sure. We get them to hand out our leaflets. Right. But in between, there's a level of instrumentality that I think is legitimate. As Lila says, faiths are instrumental in establishing, challenging or perpetuating social norms, less deeply rooted than moral norms, based on what you think the neighbours think or do. These are becoming an increasing issue within development. Back to Sen, those freedoms to be and to do. Faith leaders are often prominent public authorities, resolving disputes when the state is nowhere to be seen. So it makes sense to try and work with them. They're able to reach communities through a very important lens that others cannot tap into. Sorry for the mixed metaphor there. An insistence on secularism makes aid programs look weird and alien, laying them open to accusations of being foreign interlopers by any populist seeking to shut down those pesky CSOs. And community organizations like Citizens UK, which I love, have shown the mobilising power of working with faith organisations. Churches, mosques and synagogues often have deeper roots in communities than any other institution, certainly more than NGOs or the state. Now, okay, that's all great, and that shows that, you know, there's a range of reasons for atheists working in aid and development to come along to the event. One of the obstacles to linking faith and development is people's experience of the undoubted negative role of faith institutions, especially in areas such as women's rights. This is totally legit, but shouldn't the response be to understand the arguments, debates, and divisions within faith institutions? There are always a lot, nothing is a monolith, and build bridges with the like-minded groups rather than just write the whole lot off. In terms of the question in the title of this post, how to get the atheists to show up, I suggested showing the relevance of a faith-literate approach to some of the hot topics in development, like localization and decolonization, demonstrating the evidence of the importance and impact of faith leaders and institutions, acknowledging those difficult issues, and having a panel of atheists, preferably not including me, not all of them fellow travellers, to actually discuss whether any of this makes sense. So I hope you're persuaded. If so, I mean, I'm sure I'll be publicising the event in the spring. That's me done. The sun's come out. I'm finishing for the week. Have a great weekend. Bye.